Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if there are any boys and girls in the room. Welcome back to, as Johnny Numb would say, my co-host, to yet another episode of The Last Knock. This is your horror podcast. And tonight, Johnny isn't here. He's out with his cats dancing on rooftops or something like that, as Johnny is apt to do. And today we have a very special guest that I've been excited to have on for quite a long time. And that's because, and it's funny, we were talking about it before the show. This is going to be a little bit of a long introduction, but, you know, most horror movies are crap. You know, we know it. We've seen the same thing over and over again. And then when it comes down to found footage, the subgenre, it's maybe even more crap because anybody with an iPhone or a cheap camera can, look, we can make a movie in Tony's backyard. And they do, and maybe they shouldn't. And recently I came across a wonderful, wonderful not just a found footage film, but it goes into the mockumentary subgenre. And I put this movie up there with movies like The Last Broadcast, which is the granddaddy of them all, Lake Mungo, the wonderful Mortal Remains from Cryptic Pictures. And now we have what maybe people might have passed up a little bit because of the title, which I think is a great contrast, Butterfly Kisses. And we have the writer, director, the mastermind, the great Eric Christopher Myers here with us tonight. Eric, how are you?
I am doing super well. And you want to hear something funny?
Yes.
I was literally right before this interview, I was dancing on my rooftop with cats. So it's like I'm completely in the right zone to be on this show.
Awesome. Oh, man, that's fantastic. Well, that's... this is how the show's going to go. I love it.
Awesome. Awesome. No, and you know, you listed off a bunch of good found footage movies. I'm flattered the Butterfly Kisses that you're, you know, associating it with those. The Mortal Remains guys, I know them. They're fantastic. They're awesome dudes. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, they're working on Mortal Remains 2 is coming out sometime in the near future. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Right here in my neck of the woods.
Yeah. Oh, that's excellent. But let's get back to you because I'm watching your wonderful movie. I was, you know, Butterfly Kisses. I'm like, what the hell is that? And then I'm like, well, this is great because I love contrast. So I love the title. And I start watching this. And as a writer and a filmmaker, I'm watching this. And 10 minutes in, I'm like, this is so well crafted. And I think what you did for the mockumentary subgenre is what Wes Craven did for slasher films when he did Scream.
You're not the first person to make that comparison.
Yes.
And, you know, actually, it's funny because most people sort of preface that association with an apology. You know, don't get pissed off, but... And I'm like, hey, man, that's a huge, huge compliment. Scream was an incredibly influential film. You know, for so many people where you're able to sort of have, you know, this might sound a little pretentious, but kind of almost academic entertainment.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, any sort of meta or self-reflexive commentary on genre or subgenre is cool. It just gives it an extra layer. I mean, I loved Scream. I love Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which I realize is also a very polarizing sort of film.
Right.
But you know, you mentioned contrast before, and I absolutely love the idea of a film that has sort of an adorable and sickly sweet sort of title that, you know, is ambiguous. But when you find out what it is, you're like, oh, that's kind of dark and fucked up. So,
yeah,
I'm glad the title didn't scare you away.
Yeah, you want to tell people what it's about a little bit? Because I don't want to blow it and give something away.
It's kind of the way I try to describe it is I say that it's a fake documentary about a fake documentary about another fake documentary.
I swear to God, I was telling my co-host Johnny, I said, well, it's a mockumentary within a mockumentary within a mockumentary. And I was like, and that's why I was blown away by what you did. All I kept thinking is the pieces that you had to be aware of to move this around. And the first thing I looked up, when the movie was over, obviously I looked up you and I was like, how many documentaries has he done? I know he's had to have his start there. And I'm like, there it is. I was like, because it was
yeah,
it was so well done.
documentary is something that I particularly fell in love with when I was in film school. And I mean, I loved the format to begin with, but in terms of making my own, but I really, really have to take my hat off and reveal my bald head to my cinematographer and co-editor and co-producer, a guy named Kenny Johnson, who comes out of the world of documentary filmmaking. Specifically, he does a lot and is very well known for working in professional wrestling as an editor. And, you know, it was something that struck me as being very important when the concept of Butterfly Kisses first hit me, that I needed to find someone who was a legitimate documentary filmmaker to work with as a collaborator, specifically in terms of, you know, how do you go after shots? How do you capture a moment? And then how do we edit it in such a way that there is some level of authenticity? So Kenny Johnson brought an enormous amount to this production.
Well, that's wonderful because it looks great. It looks sharp. And it's not just that, you know, we were talking about, you know, a little bit about quality before, and at least I was. And one of the things right from the beginning is I was like, okay, you know, there's acting in here. You know, people can actually act. And I loved Seth Adam Kalick, who played Gavin. He was just, I wanted to punch him in the face. And I knew that was his character. And I just thought he just did such a great job in making this come alive.
Yeah, Seth is a guy I've known for over 20 years, and back when I was, you know, an early 20-something and writing screenplays and sort of dreaming of being a filmmaker someday, and Seth was an actor who was dreaming of being able to make films. He used to read all of my work aloud to me and perform all of the parts so that I could sort of hear and, you know, make revisions as I went. And, you know, we always said, someday we're going to make a movie. Someday we're going to collaborate together and we're going to, you know, make this happen. And of course, this is, you know, the mid-90s. This is back when making an independent film was cost prohibitive unless you had, you know, financiers or what have you. And then, of course, the landscape, as we both know, has changed so much, what with digital becoming the primary source of shooting, and then with outlets and platforms like Amazon and other streaming capabilities. You know, anybody can make a movie today. Whether everybody should is, you know, open to discussion.
No, it's not. They shouldn't. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's a... Yeah, a little of one and 17 of both. But, you know, he's an incredible actor, an incredible collaborator. And, you know, before I go too far down that rabbit hole, because I definitely want to, you know, tell you a little bit about how we filmed this and the methodology that was employed. The plot, for those who are wondering, again, yes, a fake documentary about a fake documentary about a fake documentary. And in this case... Butterfly Kisses is asking the question that found footage movies tend to sort of scurry around, which is, if we are presumably watching discovered footage, whether that's video or film canisters or whatever, of a film that was shot at some point earlier and chronicles in details the death or disappearance of the filmmakers in what is allegedly a supernatural incident, then who found the footage? Who discovered it? What compelled them to first watch it and then believe that what they were seeing is, you know, the real thing rather than an unfinished horror movie? What steps did they take to vet the footage? Mm-hmm. And what was the road that they walked in order for the film to, you know, be released in multiplexes? So Butterfly Kisses essentially tells that story, and it is a found footage movie that is intentionally utilizing all of the tropes and conventions of the subgenre as sort of popularized by the Blair Witch Project and then imitated and sequelized down the road by films like, you know, Paranormal Activity and et cetera. But wrapped around it is a documentary with finger quotes that I, playing myself, am directing, about the gentleman who found the footage, a guy named Gavin York, who is a wedding videographer in Baltimore. He's kind of a failed filmmaker, and he believes that what he has found is the Blair Witch Project, only it's real, and he's going to be able to cash in on that and launch his career in Hollywood. And so my camera crew is following him around as he's taking these tapes to various experts, whether they are folklorists or you know, people who can analyze the film and extrapolate information as to whether it's real or it's not real. And he kind of starts to go off the rails in his pursuit of the truth.
Off the rails. That's funny, knowing certain, you know, content elements. But I don't want people to get the idea, like, you know, you're going to see things hanging in trees like Blair Witch, and like it's not that at all. This, you created a great mythos that I'm not going to talk about. I thought it was really interesting, and how it came that these, let's say, the first documentarians, you know, not only got involved, but what they did to make it happen. And I thought it was very, very clever. It was really, it was just a lot of fun to watch. And that was such a blast. I loved, where'd you get the idea from? Was this brewing in your head for a while? Did you wake up from a dream with it or what?
No, like all the best ideas, it just kind of hit me one day. Yep. And I had made a film that was released in 2013 called Roulette, and it was sort of my no-budget calling card. In fact, it's on Prime for free. You can also buy it on DVD or Blu-ray. But regardless, it came out in 2013, and I was trying to decide what my next project was going to be, and I was taking a walk one day, and I was thinking about a trailer or a commercial that I just recently seen. I can't remember what found footage movie it was. Maybe it was The Last Exorcism Part 2 or something like that. But I was thinking about these films, and, you know, the blessing and the curse of the creative mind is you start picking it apart. And I went back to that very, very brief period in 1999 when the Blair Witch Project came out, and using early internet viral media, Artisan, I believe it was Artisan who released the film, they sort of perpetuated the idea that this was real. And so audiences were buying into it and thinking they were going to see a real documentary. And, you know, my wheels were really starting to spin on that. And I was asking all of those questions that I stated previously. You know, what would happen, particularly now, in this day and age, where we know for a fact that the old adage that the camera doesn't lie is complete and total bullshit, you know, what with whether it's After Effects or it's Photoshop or it's just a case of selective editing to present an idea. We know that anything that we see can be manipulated. Truth is malleable. Documentaries can't necessarily be trusted. You know, somebody like Michael Moore has a bias. You know, so
no.
Reality. Little one, just a teeny tiny one, just a little one. He's got it, just a little one. But little. You know, I mean, Morgan Spurlock, you know, the Catfish guys.
There's
a lot of discussion as to, you know, how legitimate some of this stuff is.
Yes.
Reality shows are edited or scripted, or, you know, scenes are reshot. Nothing that you see you can necessarily believe. So if somebody found a box of tapes and said, this is 10 years old and it's all about a local boogeyman and this is the real thing, how do you prove that? And even if it were, how would you get anyone to believe it? Would anybody believe?
Exactly. That was, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. The sound's so good tonight. I couldn't tell. I was like, oh man, did I lose him? All right. No, and that's so true. And that's what I loved about the movie, because it was funny with some of the things that that the main character was going up against, and the people he was going up against, going, hey man, like, what is this? Is this true? Can you help me out here? And people from groups that we might think would be very fringe and very, like, bizarro and conspiratorial were like, get out of here. Like, I loved it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I kind of used the concept of the boogeyman in this film, an entity called Peeping Tom or the Blink Man or any one of a dozen names that you heard on the playground, depending on what generation you're from. I kind of used him and, you know, even the found footage that supposedly shows his manifestation. As kind of a MacGuffin. I mean, there is whether you want to call it subtext or, you know, outright text, Butterfly Kisses is really in a lot of ways about filmmaking. And, you know, the sort of intangible quality of any form of art that exists in the artist's head and that he or she, you know, might be completely inspired by to the point where they are willing to, you know, spend a ton of money or, you know, give up their time with their family or, you know, outright alienate the people around them because they are obsessed with this thing that perhaps only they can really see the end product for in their minds. And so, you know, I tried to have the Gavin York character as played by Seth Kallick, you know, not only, as you said, bumping heads with people who are dismissing the content of the film as that isn't, you know, a real supernatural document, this isn't real, this is fake, this is whatever, but also his relationship with his wife, with the people around him who are just like, you're obsessed with this thing that you're convinced is going to propel you to, you know, riches and fame and all these things that I don't see what you see.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of what I loved about it because, you know, I think so many people are looking for, regardless of what they do, some sort of breakthrough moment in their life. And we also live in a culture now where there is no sense of adventure. It's just, you know, the Godfathers from way back did a song called Birth, School, Work, Death. And it's like, that's like it. And it's like, who wants that? We want something more. So he had a chance to, like, you know, expose something, do something cool, help his family, you know, and but yeah, so I could see where the obsession would come in. I thought it was like, well, you know, what would I do in that situation? I'd probably be doing the same thing.
I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that, you know, our borders are becoming much more confined. There is no longer such a thing as, you know, climbing Mount Everest as it was before. The you know, the ends of the world are very, very clearly defined. And so many of our mysteries are beginning to shrink and vanish and dissolve. And it's like trying to go to a place like, say, Loch Ness that's 24 miles long and a mile wide. There comes a point where you have to accept the fact that, you know, we have not been able to drag anything out kicking and screaming by the tail. You know, drones, there's so much less room for Bigfoot to hide. And, you know, it's impossible to prove or disprove the existence of God. It's a maddening sort of quest, and this world is shrinking, and that's a very hard thing for some people. But then, you know, on the flip side, you can see where that would inspire someone and compel them if they think that they have some sort of insight to want to be able to share that, whether that's for financial reward or simply to expose people to something that, you know, it makes them less boring, as you said.
Yeah. And you know what? You just reminded me of something. Because I thought, I didn't realize that the Blink Man that you were talking about is a legend. So I never heard of it in my life until I watched your movie.
Well, there's a reason for that, and that's because it's complete and total bullshit that was manufactured for the film.
Because you had said, oh, geez, Louise. Okay, well, that was awesome. I like that.
Thank you. For those listening who haven't seen the movie, there is a train tunnel in Maryland. It's bored into the side of a sheer rock face, and it is accessible only by a trestle that spans the Patapsco River below. The tunnel is called Ilchester Tunnel, and it was part of the original Old Main Line for the B&O Railroad. This is a place that has a reputation for being haunted, and kids go up there at midnight and they hoot and they holler and they run around and they scare themselves to death. And I was one of them. As a teen, I went up there all the time. But it's a location that does not have a specific apparition or boogeyman that has been attached to it. It's just a nebulous, you know, scary things happen up there. So because Butterfly Kisses has a very unique meta and self-reflexive format, which is that the documentary that is talking all about this found footage that Gavin York has supposedly discovered, this documentary is filled with real people playing themselves, including, as I said, myself, all of whom are Google verifiable, some names you might have heard of. And I took a real place and I created this entity called Peeping Tom, called the Blink Man, that the film is telling you, and coming out of the mouths of real people, telling you that this is a real legend. It's not. And the legend, insofar as the film goes, is that if you go to Ilchester Tunnel at midnight, and if you stand on the far end of the trestle, and if you stare down the length of the tunnel for exactly 1 hour, beginning at the stroke of midnight until the chimes ring 1 a.m., and if you can do this without blinking your eyes once, which is a superhuman feat that very few people can actually pull off, but if you are one of the rare people who can, Peeping Tom will manifest in your sight at the end of the tunnel. However, the caveat there is that once you have seen him, you cannot unsee him. And every time you blink your eyes, he gets one step closer and one step closer and one step closer until he is nose to nose with you. And as you're holding out and doing everything you can not to blink that last time, he reaches out with his long eyelashes and begins tickling your cheeks so that you'll blink and so that he can scare you to death. This legend is something that I sort of, independently of the film, wrote some articles under pseudonyms and put them out there on various websites, just again to sort of, you know, go with the fun meta nature of this fake documentary. And the strange thing is that while the film was touring film festivals all throughout 2018, as it's leading up to its release this past Halloween, independent of the film itself, the legend began to sort of take on a life of its own until it started showing up on YouTube paranormal shows. It showed up on Creepypasta, it showed up on Reddit, and it's a really cool thing to go, well, you know, if all urban legends sort of have an inciting incident that leads to something that becomes self-perpetuating, maybe I accidentally created one. And if so, that's super cool.
Yeah, that's excellent. And again, I mean, you created something that was engaging. It was fun. It was different. I loved how you were addressing like trope after trope after trope from like what we've been hammered into our heads for like over 20 years now, you know, in this particular subgenre, and you know, and having this character like fight for like it's the legitimacy of what he found, and you know, having, and it was great because it just the element of conflict in there, the internal one, the external one, you know, with his you know, with family, with strangers, it was incredible. It was so multi-layered. And I how, when you were writing this, how difficult was it to put it on paper? Did you find yourself, did it just come out of your head? Or were you like, oh man, you know, I need to like put stuff on a board and figure this out because I have like three separate stories going on? Or how did it work for you as the writer of it?
It was actually really easy. Good, and great. I'm a super fast writer, and I tend to, you know, my first draft tends to be pretty polished, you know, whether you like it or you don't like it. It comes out more or less the way that I want it, and I refine as I go. And in the case of this particular script, and, you know, keep in mind, like I said, I made another film called Roulette, and I've also written screenplays for various other filmmakers. So this wasn't, you know, the first thing I'd ever done.
Right.
Nonetheless, you sit down and, you know, as an idea is spinning through your head, and particularly one like this where I'm going, it's like an onion, there's going to be all these various layers that you peel back. It came out in 7 or 8 days very quickly. It was the most
Wow, man.
It was the easiest screenplay that I've ever written. And
wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes from the fact that, as you said, Butterfly Kisses talks a lot about the tropes and conventions of the subgenre, and academic criticism is something that I'm very, very into, specifically with film. So, there were you know, obviously character arcs and plot twists and all of that, but the script really wrote itself in that respect because I was able to sort of say, okay, this found footage movie I'm making that you know is the core of Butterfly Kisses. It is something that I want to feel for the viewer as being fun and entertaining, hopefully a little bit scary, but most importantly, very, very familiar. Mm-hmm. I want it to feel like, you know, you're there about to shout out what's going to happen next. But the gag here is that the documentary wrapped around it starts beating you to the punch and starts addressing and pointing out all of the tropes and conventions as we go. So mm-hmm. in that respect, it was so fun to write because it was sort of like, you know, responding to myself back and forth and having a dialogue on the page.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it was easy for you, because when an idea strikes like that and it's like rock solid and your unconscious state just unleashes it into your conscious state and you can put it on paper, that's phenomenal. That was great to hear. Oh, that was wonderful, because it really was so, probably, you know, just saying it over and over again, but it's so well crafted. The structure just really impressed me, how you tailored the story and how you had these stories interwoven so well. It was a treat. And I remember I was tired that night, and I'm like, oh, I'm probably going to fall asleep. And I didn't. And that was really good.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, that's the greatest compliment you can ever, you know, give any artist, is your shit did not make me pass out. But no, I mean, it's a great compliment. And I owe, you know, I owe a lot of gratitude and respect and recognition is due to, again, Kenny Johnson, who, mm-hmm. you know, shot this thing and co-edited it with me. Because if there was a struggle with the writing, it was that, you know, this sort of film is a rabbit hole. You can keep going down and you can go further and further and
sure,
further.
There's
so much to mine. And when the film was shot and when I sat down in front of my Mac and I did the first assembly, and keep in mind that, you know, as I was putting it together, I was saying, you know, I have a wealth of information here and I'm only going to use scenes and moments that I know are indispensable. Anything that is superfluous, I'm not going to put into this assembly. And it was still 3 hours long. So, mm-hmm. you know, Kenny became vital in coming in and sort of mercilessly going through and, again, bringing his documentary background and acumen to the fore. And in addition to that, there were so many awesome, you know, Maryland filmmakers who watched the film and gave me their thoughts. And, you know, we did a test screening, which I'd never done before, that the producers put on. And,
wow.
you know, we had people come in off the street who had comment cards and a focus group afterwards. And I'm hiding in the back. I shaved my beard, trying to disguise myself, and just listening to everyone tell you, you know, what's wrong with your film rather than what's right. Because, you know, we're here to, you know, make it shorter. We're here to make it more concise, which is a tough thing to do when you have all of these layers and all of these concepts and you want all of them to be, you know, firmly established and not, you know, triple underlined, but at the same time not go over your head, hopefully.
Yeah, well, how did that go? I mean, I could see, you know, going into a test screening with much trepidation. I mean, you could edit down, which is great, but it's like, you know, independent film. I'm not sure how you raised the money for it. I don't know if you'd like, oh, honey, I'm taking out a second mortgage on a house or not. But, you know, you've made a considerable investment and it's like, this has got to work. You might, Did you drink a lot before you went in there or what?
No, I drank a lot afterward. And, you know, I've never been in that position. And I've shown my work at many film festivals in my time. And I've, you know, if you want to feel naked, you put your art up on a gigantic screen for a couple hundred people and sit there and hope that they react correctly. It's a very intimidating thing. But, you know, in this case, it was intimidating in a way that it had never been when Roulette played for people, because Butterfly Kisses wasn't finished. It didn't, you know, it had temp score and it didn't, you know, the color grading wasn't done and the sound wasn't professionally mixed. And, you know, you realize that some people are very good at watching a rough cut or even a fine cut and being able to fill in the blanks. And these tend to be filmmakers or the friends and spouses of filmmakers or, you know, real film enthusiasts. However, when you just have, you know, Joe Walmart watching it and they're like, that doesn't sound like it. You know, you have people that can't get past sort of, you know, things, very surface level things, to be able to give you constructive feedback about the rest. I was, however, very gratified by how insightful the audience was in this case. And the coolest moment that came out of that was there's a scene in the film that is it's a jump moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm not typically a huge fan of jump scares. However, because I was trying to make sure that I, you know, checked off all the boxes of what an audience would expect, not simply of my film, but, you know, an audience would expect of this found footage that this Gavin York character is showing around, there had to be a jump moment. So I put one in, and I'd never done anything like that. And throughout the editing process, you become very desensitized to what you're looking at, and it's hard to see it objectively anymore. And so I'm sitting here going, this jump, it's not going to work. People aren't going to respond to it. It's just going to fall flat. And I'm standing there in the back of the room with my producers, and the moment comes on screen, and an entire row of girls screamed and literally launched out of their chairs.
Nice.
And we just all looked at one another, and we just gave tight-lipped smiles and nodded our heads very slowly. And we're like, it worked.
Yep.
Can't believe it worked that effectively. And the great thing is that all throughout 2018, as I showed this film all over the United States and Canada, always audiences screamed and leaped out of their chairs. And so I'm sitting here going, wow, the thing I hate in movies, it seems to be a standout moment here.
Well, I mean, it depends on... it depends on the film, how it's shot. I mean, there's so many
it's all about how it's used.
Yeah,
it's all about why it's used.
Yeah, and you could see it, you know, if you could see it coming a mile away. To me, the best jump scares is like, you know, I don't need the music crap. I don't, like, just bring it and, you know, rock my world or it won't, you know, whatever. But yeah, I've seen jump scares that are like, you know, hideous and awful and pathetic and, you know, telescoped a mile and away, and others that, you know, just really, really get me and knock me flat. And so that's great. You did it right. Cause that's,
yeah. I mean, they tend not to work on me personally. They aren't very effective for me, but in my mind, the best jump scare, and I had this in mind the entire time that I was making Butterfly Kisses, is in the sort of criminally underrated Exorcist 3.
Yes.
There is a moment in that film that, you know, if you go on YouTube, if you go on Google, if you type in best jump scares of all time, there is this moment in the Exorcist 3 that is not simply effective because of, you know, the punchline, the thing that makes you jump, but the buildup, the setup. It's so eloquently done. And like you said, there's no music. It's just a slow burn. And every time you think something's going to happen, it doesn't, until you let your guard down and then boom, William Peter Blatty hits you. And I will never forget being 14 and seeing that film in the theater on opening day and hearing for the first time in my life an audience shriek. I'd never experienced anything like that. And I had that so deeply in my mind as I was, you know, trying to craft this sequence and going, man, wouldn't it be cool? You know, wouldn't it be cool if I could make Exorcist 3 happen here? So.
Oh, that's funny. I actually saw a movie. It's the greatest scare I've ever experienced in my life in a film. Nothing has come close. And the movie's absolutely, it's bad. It's a bad movie. It was poorly casted. The people are like, well, the main character is like, she's like wood. But there was a scare in this film. It's called Dark Remains. And when I saw this thing, it was as if I was levitated or being abducted by aliens and they were sucking me out of the room with a tractor beam, because my entire body came off the couch like 3 feet in the air. I thought I was having a heart attack. I actually fell on a floor, and I'm like, man, is like, what's going on in my life? And you know, that just got to me. And I go online and I'm looking up things about this movie, and this guy announces, I'm a 6'5", 300-pound black man, and when that scene happened, I shot out through the window out into the street. And it was just hilarious. But yeah, otherwise jump scares really, you know, it's rare that they get me.
Well, I'm a 5'6", pasty white, sort of jaded cinephile, but now Dark Remains is going to be added to my Netflix queue because I got to see this.
Yeah, I'm not telling you the scene, you know, where it's at or anything like that, but...
Awesome.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, I watch so many, you know, commercial horror films and I just sit there and it's like, there's like no reaction. And even from the audiences, I see a horror movie in the theater and it's, you know, commercial film, commercial horror, and we all just sit there and that's not good.
And, you know, and that's part of the reason why I wasn't sure whether the jump would work. And, you know, because audiences are so... you know, not simply jaded and cynical, but they are tuned in to all of the tropes. I mean, Whatever is cool the first time, once it's imitated and we've all seen it multiple times, then what was once original and creative becomes, you know, simply, you know, a standard. We know where, you know, what the hero's journey is going to be in a superhero
exactly.
movie. We know who's going to get killed in a slasher. We know these things.
Yeah.
And we know that in horror films, there's going to be, you know, the quieter the film gets, the more likely that there's going to be a false scare that's going to then dovetail into a real scare. And we all see that coming. And I definitely, you know, it's challenging when... In this case, because it is a film that is talking about those things.
Exactly.
I said, it's got to be there, but it's also got to work. It's a juggling act.
You know what the funny thing is? If your movie was 3 hours long, I still would have just enjoyed it just as much because it was so loaded. There wasn't anything wasted in it from a storytelling perspective at all. It wasn't like, oh, man, this scene, like, what's going on? Every scene had its... its element of conflict and importance. The timing was great for everything. It was really well paced. So I love it. I love what you did.
Thank you. That's really, really gratifying to hear because it was hard. I mean, it was literally a year of editing. With Kenny and I going back and forth and passing our edits back and forth and sending notes and, you know, locking horns quite a bit because, you know, I'm sitting there going, you know, the horror is really important. And he's sitting there going, yes, but the documentary aspect is really important. So, you know, trying to find that sweet spot. But, you know, it's interesting because even as detached as you become from your work and, you know, I mean emotionally detached to the point where you can become annoyed with what you have. I never thought that the 3-hour cut was boring. I never thought that it was over long. If anything, I looked at the first cut and went, you know, for about 5 minutes, I was saying to the producers, I was like, you know, maybe we should retrofit this into a 5 or 6 part, you know, miniseries of half hour episodes, you know, and build climaxes and build bumpers and all of that. And, you know, while the information was there, while the, you know, I think it could be entertaining in that format, we also realized that on an independent level, you know, a lot of what you have to do, apart from awesome podcasts like this one, is you have to do film festivals, you have to build an audience out there in talking, and you really got to do that with a feature film.
Yeah, that's true. No, I understand that. So, on the Blu-ray, is there going to be is there a full version or?
No, the Blu-ray, it came out in October, and it's pretty much a bare bones release.
Okay, no, that's fine.
It's you know, we had a ton of extra content that could have gone on the disc, but you know, it's an independent film, and distributors are like, you know, just put the film out there. So
exactly,
I'm very grateful. Our distributor, Gravitas Ventures, they've released a ton of great stuff that's gotten out there to very wide audiences. Mm-hmm. And you know, this film had about, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 offers. I was just floored that Gravitas gave us the offer that they did. However, there are all these bonus materials, and there is this 3-hour cut, and I would love someday for people to have the opportunity to hear and see some of this stuff.
Yeah, that's what I love. Special edition, I could see that in the near future. That'd be great.
Yeah, so everybody listening to this, please go out and buy 10 copies. And not only will my son be able to go to college, but it will show the demand to the distributor.
Oh.
Vote with your dollars, folks.
Oh, man, there it is. Well, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the editing, the end result. But like when you first, you know, when you got this on paper, then you obviously, you know, you're not just writing a screenplay for like, you know, fun. You want to film it. You know, you're a filmmaker. What were your biggest challenges bringing this all together pre-production?
Honestly, the hardest part with trying to get any independent film off the ground is money and resources and time. And, you know, unless you are, you know, employed by or backed by a studio, or you have investors with very deep pockets and you're able to quit your job, independent films, you know, tend to be either shot very, very quickly so that everything can be done in a, you know, a finite period of time,
right,
or else you have to become, you know, sort of an overnight and weekend warrior sort of filmmaker. And that's what I was in the case of this film. You know, just trying to say, I have to understand and be respectful of the fact that everybody working on this film, the cast and the crew, we all have day jobs, or, you know, in the case of some people, they work on evenings and weekends. You know, many of us have children, many of us have spouses, and, you know, other commitments. It's a very difficult thing to try to schedule and, you know, get something where you are retaining momentum and you're still able to get it accomplished quickly, because the longer something dangles, you don't just run into problems of keeping people motivated, but you also run into continuity errors and things like that. So that was the hardest part, you know, having to, you know, go out there and say, hey, you know, I made this movie Roulette. It won a bunch of awards. It came out. You know, I'm doing my next film and I need you to do this and I need you to do that, and to make sure that you inspire and motivate the people whom you wish to work with. And I was very lucky in that regard. It's just, again, the short answer to a long-winded answer is just trying to be able to carve out the time and do things efficiently.
Gotcha. How long was the shoot?
It was done in 2 blocks, and the reason for that is twofold. The first is that I wanted to shoot the found footage during the dead of winter, and so that everything had a very specific look. And then I wanted to shoot the documentary wrapped around it during the height of summer, so that when we revisit certain locations, you see a very dramatic difference in the environment, and it helps to sort of subliminally guide the viewer into thinking, well, yeah, this clearly wasn't all shot in one go. I can believe or suspend disbelief and say that this looks like it was filmed 10 years apart. The other reason for that was the fact that it was vital to be able to shoot out the found footage and cut it together so that I had a mini movie that I would be able to let Gavin York, the actor playing him, Seth Kalik, be able to watch and rewatch and rewatch and take extensive notes on so that he knew it like the back of his hand.
Right.
But then be able to let all of the real people who appear in the film as themselves, and specifically sort of talking head people like, you know, David Sterrett, who is a very, very famous, you know, film theorist and critic and author, and Steve Yeager, who won the award at Sundance for Divine Trash, and people who were commenting on the film and the tropes. I needed them to be able to watch it and study it themselves. So it was this weird sort of production where it was the same crew, but you know, two different periods in the same year with a completely different cast, and it made your head spin a little bit.
Yeah, but it was smart. But I could what you did, but I could also see it's like, okay, we got this done. Now we have to wait till the end of the summer to do the rest of it. And you must have been chomping at the bit to get out there.
I was, but there really wasn't as much downtime as you would think. And simply by virtue of the fact that we not only had to cut all of the found footage together and then be able to, you know, add the special effects where needed. But I was working very, very extensively with, and I want to say that in the documentary, the faux documentary, there are only three actors. There's Gavin and his wife and his mother-in-law, and then everybody else is real. I was doing these extensive sort of, you know, mind game acting boot camp, you know, training sessions with Seth so that he knew this stuff like the back of his hand, so that then he'd be able to go out and interact with real people, with real experts on folklore. But I needed to get the folklore people spun up on this. I needed to get paranormal investigators spun up on this. I was working nonstop leading up to the second shoot.
Oh man, I can imagine. I had a question in my head and it ran away. I have so many.
Usually with me, that's just women who run away.
So. I hate when that happens.
Yeah, and that inspires the most questions.
Crud. Oh man, it was. It'll come back to me. But the so post production, you said took a year. Editing alone.
Yes. And that was again, you know, with the found footage already being cut. But, you know, what you see in the movie, I don't know what the exact runtime is, but you probably see about
91 minutes.
Yeah, but the found footage makes up maybe 25, 30 minutes of that. And the original found footage cut was, you know, in excess of an hour. So that gives you a sense of, you know, just how delicate the editing was, because it'd be like, okay, you know, the goal for this cut is, you know, I got to lose half an hour. Now the goal for this cut is I've got to lose 15 minutes, and then I got to lose 5 minutes. And, you know, it was getting down to like 1 minute, 2 minutes. And because 90 minutes is really sort of the commercial standard, specifically for horror and very specifically for independent films.
Yeah.
And that was very, very challenging. And it was also very weird, weird in the sense that it was a great learning experience for me as an editor, because, you know, Roulette, for example, it came out and I think it's an hour and 53. And in this case, because everyone was hitting me over the head and going 90 minutes, that's the magic number, I'm finding these weird sort of paradoxes while cutting. Wherein if you cut, you know, you make one of the scenes shorter, great, boom, it flows even better now. But it makes all of the scenes around it longer. And the shorter the movie got, the longer certain sections felt. So it was just this weird, weird, but very, very, very instructive sort of exercise for me.
Excellent. And now I remember my question, because it escaped me. You did the casting yourself for the film, correct?
I did. I definitely had some assistance from some actors and people who were plugged into the area. Seth helped with some of it. An actress named Ali Lukowski helped with some of it. But yeah, it was largely, you know, sort of going under the radar. And you know how a lot of independent filmmakers do the whole, you know, they do a Kickstarter or they shoot sort of promo trailer for what they're going to do. And I wanted to go the opposite direction in that after Roulette, a lot of people were saying, what are you doing next? I want to work with you. And I felt like the best thing I could do with Butterfly Kisses was to try to keep the production as quiet as humanly possible and really only let people know, particularly on social media, who the real people appearing as themselves were. And just so people were asking, what the hell is this? The title's ambiguous. The poster's ambiguous. Is it a documentary? Is it not? So casting was done very, very quietly. And we actually had a cattle call where I was only, for the found footage specifically, I wanted faces who were, you know, relatively new.
Right.
And so I was going after theater people more than I was going after film people. Nice. And we held these auditions in a restaurant that was closed for the day. And I'm hiding in the back room and we're not telling people what it was. And they're getting fake sides. And it was a lot of fun. It was very cloak and dagger.
That's cool. And theater people are great because they know how to improv. So with, you know, found footage too, you know, they could have a little more maybe natural take when it comes to dialogue, hopefully.
That was another reason I was going after theater folks, because I wanted to do about three takes for every scene in the found footage. And that was, you know, take number one, stay on book. Take number two, feel free to wiggle around, but stay on book. And take number three, go full improv, incorporate what's in the scene, but just take it. And so what you nice. See in the finished movie, you know, scenes might have a little bit of all three.
Gotcha. Was one more prevalent than the other at the end of the day when you were doing your tallies, you know, with like, wow, the improv stuff like worked more, or was it, you know, staying on script, or?
It was, I would say it was a pretty even mix.
Oh, okay.
And, it, you know, it was funny the way that worked out, because some of the improv stuff might give you the most natural content, but at the same time, some of that improv stuff might, you know, go too far off to the point where, you know, you've got to rein that scene in. I did find I had a tendency to utilize takes, both in the found footage and the fake documentary, where if someone stumbled over their words or they mispronounced something or their grammar was poor, I used those takes because they felt more real. It added a little sort of invisible verisimilitude to the scene.
Yeah, I can understand that. So what did you, as a filmmaker, what from this entire experience with this particular film, Butterfly Kisses, what did you learn? What was like the biggest thing that you learned from it that you're going to carry over to your other projects?
I learned that I had to have a bit more controlled chaos than I had ever worked with, whether that was on a short film, whether that was a movie like Roulette, which had a huge ensemble. But it was all very, you know, I wrote these words, you use these words, you know, saying to my cinematographer, I want these precise shots, and the crane's going to go on this line, and the Steadicam is going to do X, Y, and Z. In the case of Butterfly Kisses, it had to be controlled chaos. And it meant that I had to rely on Kenny as the cinematographer in a way that I normally wouldn't, because, you know, it was like, you know, we intentionally did not do shot lists or storyboards, and I wanted to give the actors and the real people, because real people were a whole other, I mean, it's a whole other conversation when you're working with people who are not actors, and many of whom have never been in front of the camera. I needed to sort of turn them loose and then say, you know, okay, we're going to grab the camera and we just got to get in there. And, you know, saying to a documentary filmmaker, I want you to treat this like it's real. I want you to shoot this like you really would if you were capturing a legitimate moment. And, you know, the actors tended not to have marks. They had to just, you know, inhabit the location wherever that was.
Nice.
And I had to give people a freedom that I'd never done before. And that was exhilarating, but it was also terrifying.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'd like to think that that made me a better director. I'd like to think it made me a better editor. You know, having trust in people and, you know, taking off the auteur hat just a little bit, But by that same, you know, by that same virtue, realizing, you know, where you need to be able to tighten the reins, but also where to trust people. It was a very unique filming experience and editing experience.
Excellent. And well, you pulled it off. I mean, everybody, you know, should be, you know, thrilled with the how it came out, because
thank you.
Very wonderful. And we're going to use that as a segue, because after Butterfly Kisses, we now have 8 Ball Clown 2 coming out. Is that true?
So 8 Ball Clown is a film that, God, I think it's actually coming out next week.
Holy shit. Oh my gosh.
I didn't direct it. It's by a filmmaker named Mark Schell, who was mm-hmm. a producer on Butterfly Kisses.
Right.
And he has this film starring a very talented actor named Jacob Ledoux. And it's you know,
but you
intentionally
wrote it.
Mark did. So he wrote and directed this film, and he, you know, very run and gun, you know, he did most of the shooting himself, and, you know, it's a family effort. His kids star in it as well. Very, very cool like that, you know, and doing kind of an intentionally sort of schlocky USA Up All Night style horror film. And with no, you know, no delusions of grandeur. This is fun. This is over the top. It's goofy. And so when I was in post on Butterfly Kisses, you know, Mark, who again was a producer on the film, said, I want to do 8 Ball Clown 2. Would you like to come in and direct? It's going to be an opportunity to just, you know, again, minimal crew. I was doing shooting as well as directing. Actors and crew people were all friends who were coming over and hanging out, and were drinking scotch and making a ridiculous over-the-top kind of movie. Just an opportunity to sort of say, no pressure, have fun.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's I'm editing that right now.
Okay, yeah, because I have you listed here as director and writer, co-writer and definitely director.
Yeah, yeah.
All right,
just
cool.
A fun opportunity to work with very cool people.
Excellent. And on that note, I'm going to give you the final question for the night, but not forever, because you're going to come back on the show again in the future, because you're awesome and I want you on here again. But
awesome. If you want to check out my film Roulette, again, that's on Prime right now.
I have
check it out. And if you want to talk about that or about anything else in the world, I'm having fun, so please
cool.
have me back.
Oh, that's a definite. So the last question of the night, this is one that people normally hate. So here it is. You've been doing interviews, correct?
I have, yes.
All right. So what have you been waiting for an interviewer to ask of you that they never seem to do? So what is it? What would that question be? And what's the answer?
A specific question about the film or a general question about filmmaking?
Whatever you want it to be, this is your question.
There is, in the effort to try to blend reality and fantasy in Butterfly Kisses, again, the found footage is mostly made up of fresh faces, and the documentary is made up of a lot of people playing themselves who you can find on Google, including but not limited to Eduardo Sanchez, the director of the Blair Witch Project. He appears in this
mm-hmm.
movie.
Yes, he does.
So in an effort to, you know, allow the viewer to suspend disbelief and go with the premise and have a little bit of fun, I put a couple of Easter eggs in there. And one of them is the fact that the two film students who presumably shoot the found footage movie, there is the director, who is you know, a type A personality named Sophia,
mm-hmm.
played by the very lovely and talented Rachel Armiger. And then there is her cameraman, Feldman, who is played by a great guy named Reed Delisle. And Feldman is intentionally only ever referred to as Feldman.
Right.
And this is one of the things built into the documentary, that Gavin is trying to prove this stuff is real. So he's trying to go to every college, and he's trying to find the professor that appears in it, and he's trying to find the film students, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So this character Feldman, who is only ever given one name, we never state, is it his first name? Is it his last name? But I planted Easter eggs inside of the film where you can possibly determine whether it's a first or a last name. And no one ever in any interview has ever asked about it or commented on it or stated that they saw those Easter eggs.
Well, I haven't. I have to watch it again. I'm like, son of a bitch. I hate it when I miss something.
Yes, yeah, so to all the listeners out there who have either seen Butterfly Kisses and are going to watch it again, or have not seen Butterfly Kisses, hit me up on Twitter at EKMYERS or at BKMovie2018 or find me on Facebook and let me know if you found those Easter eggs because I'm waiting for somebody to comment on them.
Son of a bitch, you got, man, the question backfired.
I was expecting a hard question. I was expecting you to really, really give me something crazy, like, you know, no. what's my kid's birthday or, you know, no. Something like that.
No, people hate that question. They really do. They're like, oh, man, oh, son of a bitch, I got nothing. Oh, man, you know, and they just – and then I had one person go into a political rant once. Well, they were starting to, and they, like, pulled themselves in, and I was like, oh, boy. But, yeah, it's the first time it came back on me.
Damn. Yeah, well, political rants are fun, just maybe not on, you know, film shows. And my kid's birthday is really easy to remember because yeah. My wife was induced on August 15th, and I remember saying to her, can't we do this tomorrow? Because August 16th, that's the anniversary of Elvis dying. What, you know, that's like, wow. That would be really, really cool if maybe, you know, Biggie was reincarnated through our child. And she had the absolute, you know, she had the great and lovely and wonderful desire to grant me my wish and stayed in labor for 24 hours.
Holy crap.
Well, she didn't. She actually didn't do it on purpose. But I'm trying to give you credit. So, Laura, if you're listening, well done,
Laura. You poor. Oh man, I don't know how women do it, man. With some parasitic alien getting ready to pop out of their stomach, I can't. Oh my God, I can't even imagine. That's hard to me.
Have you had kidney stones before?
No, but I heard they're worse. I heard
they're bad.
Yeah,
they're
I heard from nurses that they're like, oh yeah. It's worse than giving birth to a child. I'm like, holy crap.
Well, I actually, right before my son was born, I was in the hospital on my wedding anniversary of all days. And
great timing.
It was perfect timing to have about 3 months of chronic kidney stones.
Oh,
and then
God.
I got one lodged in my ureter. And so what that meant was, did you ever watch Deadwood?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Poor
yeah,
Ian McShane. So holy crap.
Ian McShane, and it's like, I got to pee. I can't pee. Oh. And so they had to go in there, do invasive surgery. And, you know, that was okay because they put me under. It was the removal of the stent that I thought they were going to put me under for again. And they said, oh, no, you're going to be awake for this.
Oh.
So if you've ever wanted to know what it was like sort of to piss backwards.
Oh, my God.
There's some mysteries a man should never know about his own body. But I felt solidarity when my son was born. I was like, yeah, yeah, I get this. I qualify.
Wow, this is the first show I've ended in pain. I'm in physical pain now just thinking of all of this nightmarish stuff. Holy crap.
Well, you know, kidney stones, they're the gift that keep giving. So hopefully I've spread a little bit of love.
Oh, well, you spread something. All right. Well, you wanted to, before we go away, why don't you tell people any other spots where they could find you on maybe Facebook, Twitter, social media, and your wonderful movies?
I think that's really funny that as you're trying to wrap it up and you're at a loss for words, you use the words go away. So, But no, as I said before, you can find me on Twitter at EKMYERS. You can also find the movie on Twitter at BKMovie2018. Butterfly Kisses has a page on Facebook. I have a page, Eric Christopher Myers on Facebook. Peeping Tom the Blink Man has a page on Facebook where you can find all the bullshit articles and things that people have expanded on since. Butterfly Kisses is available on DVD and Blu-ray through Amazon, but also through Best Buy and Target and Barnes & Noble and everywhere you could expect to find it. It's also streaming for free on Amazon Prime right now. You can also find it on Roku and Vudu and all the things that end in ooh. Same with my last film, Roulette. You can find that there as well. So check the stuff out. Hit me up on social media. Let me know what you think.
Fantastic. And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, you can find this show, The Last Knock Horror Podcast, as always, at CrashPalaceProductions.com and also on iTunes. Eric, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure, and definitely want you on again soon.
Oh, absolutely. The pleasure is mine. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for letting me horrify you and ruin your day.
Yeah, you did. Maybe I should write a horror script about kidney stones. Maybe I'll do that.
I think you should. It needs to be done.
Okay. On that note, have a good night. Thank you.
Do the same, my friend.
Alrighty. Bye.